Welcome to the Birth Warrior Podcast. In each episode, we feature the stories of birth warriors, women who have persevered to find their own truth in pregnancy and birth. As you hear these women share their stories of love, autonomy, connection, and power, it is our deepest wish that you will be inspired, empowered, and supported to find your own truth. We are honored these women have stepped forward to share their personal stories and to help us remember that we all have the power to choose what is right for us. The Birth Warrior Podcast is a presentation of the Indie Birth Association and is not intended to be medical advice.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Birth Warrior Podcast. I am your host, Jaden Graham. For today's episode, I had the absolute pleasure of speaking with Valerie. Valerie is a first-year alumnus of Indie Birth Midwifery School, serving Northern Arizona with sacred pregnancy, birth, and postpartum support. A leader in the sacred living movement, she trains people online worldwide in the art of sacred postpartum healing. Birthing 14 babies in her primal power has fueled her passion to serve her birthing community as a traditional independent midwife. Her mantra for birth is to trust and embrace the birth process, surrender to your body and baby with an open heart and mind. Valerie, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Jaden. I'm so excited to be here.
Yay. So glad to have you. Just wherever you would like to start in your journey.
Okay. Yeah. So my birth story, I have a lot of birth stories, and they do climax really with the twin birth in 1990. So those guys are 19 years old now. They'll be 20. And I had one baby after that. But just my thought process from the beginning and how I started and where it led me to through the years and throughout my different births, and just being in the bubble of trusting myself in the way things played out. So our first baby, I was living in Illinois, and midwifery was illegal. You couldn't have just a home birth with a midwife there. And so we hitchhiked to Tennessee to the farm, Ina Mae Gaskin, Stephen Gaskin. And because I thought, I am not going to the hospital. I've heard the birth stories of my mom where they're strapped down, given, you know, some medication and they wake up, whatever, you know, just feet in stirrups and all the fear that went with that. It's like, I don't trust doctors. I had enough, like some health issues when I was growing up because my parents both smoked. And so in my dealings with doctors, like I didn't trust them. They were not trustworthy in my mind at all. So we hitchhiked 8 months, 7.5 months pregnant to the farm in Tennessee and had our first baby under the midwifery care, Ina Mae, and all the midwives. I think there was about at least a dozen at the time. My midwife was one of the twins. But the funny thing is with my births, the midwives never made it. So it was a full moon and I went into labor and it was like clockwork. I lost my mucus plug. Contraction started 15 minutes later. We're eating dinner in this room with 30 people in this three-story log cabin and the excitement, you know. And so that was the thing. Like, I didn't fear birth. I was excited and I was willing to work as hard as it took to get the kind of birth I wanted from the beginning because I didn't trust other people. I trusted myself. And so it was worth hitchhiking and the uncertainty and like breaking all the rules back in that day, you know, as the baby, the family, and knowing what we were doing is pretty radical. But it was worth it. And so they did things a certain way, and very interestingly, at the time, they were giving all the women episiotomies. So at that time, that was the only one I ever had, and I don't know that it was necessary, but that's just the way they did it. They did things a certain way because it was a commune, and you know they just had to work it that way, I guess you would say. And that was really miserable for me. Like for the next year, suffered through that, and was like that didn't seem right to me at all. So then we had moved around a lot, ended up in Tucson for the second baby, and that's Blossom. And so the interesting thing, we had not lived there very long, and we're just doing our thing. And one night I had a dream that my baby was going to come early. And so I was only 6 months pregnant, and it was super vivid. Like, you just knew, like, it shook me. And the next morning I said, you know, we should look for a midwife because I had this dream the baby's coming early, like maybe something's going to happen. So we said, yeah, we should. And then a few days went by and nothing happened. And I had a second dream that the baby was coming early. So we, you know, within a couple of days, they have a training school. Tucson training midwives. I don't know what the name of it was. So met with a midwife and had our first, you know, client relationship. And 2 days later, I went into labor. That was 28 weeks, and it was University Hospital. So it was a teaching hospital. I went in scared to death. I was bleeding. And called my husband home, and we went over to the hospital, called the midwife. She met us there. And so doctors came in, a lot of doctors, like a room full of doctors, because they were all, you know, in med school, and people were coming in and out, and like, you know, on this case, they get to check out. But I was in such a, I think, hormonal and fear mode, like that didn't matter. I just wanted to make sure I was going to be okay. And so they did every kind of test. Oh, you're going to be fine. You're not going to have your baby today. You're going to get to go home. And then he did an internal check, and I was 7 centimeters dilated. So she came about 20 minutes later, and the room was packed with all kinds of teaching students, and they wanted to do everything, including using forceps on my little 2-pound baby. So my husband put his foot down. No, absolutely not. So, you know, there wasn't that intervention. But after going through midwifery school, it broke my heart to know that a premature baby needs their blood more than any, even a full-term baby. And when they cut the cord so quickly, they're losing more like a third of their blood. And they go into a, you know, shock, and causes a lot of problems where they need oxygen. And it causes a lot of the problems that would not be there, I believe, if they didn't intervene. So much so that by the end, and when we had brought her home at 4 pounds and 12 ounces, like 6 weeks later, that if we had another premature baby, we were going to do it at home, and we were going to, you know, do it our way. We were not going to go through that again. So she was gavage fed, and I was still nursing Scarlett, my first baby, at the time. So I got to, you know, keep my milk up. And so when Blossom came home, tandem nurse for a while, and then just, you know, nursed her, and she grew and, really healthy girl. So, you know, that was that experience. And a little while later, you know, a few months later, got pregnant again. So this is my third baby, 1983. My first was born in 1980. So they're about like 17 months apart. And at that time, we were living in Minnesota. And so this baby, it was just after Blossom, and that the way the pregnancy ended early and the fear and all of that, there was a little bit of fear at the beginning with the third pregnancy. But when I went past the 6 month, and then into the 7th and 8th and 9th, and I actually went 2 weeks overdue, and she was 9 pounds. So the cool thing about that, so anyway, the first baby was a full moon. There was a full bull born right outside our window at the same time I was birthing my baby, and it was just so beautiful. Same with Blossom, I believe it was a full moon. Third baby, full moon and lunar eclipse, and it was an orgasmic birth. So I know I'm going to focus on the twins, but there's just been specific things along the way that like confirm.
No, it's great. It's great to hear all of it. It's great to hear, you know, because obviously all of these experiences led you to the, you know, to the focal point, to the birth of your twins. And yeah, it's great. I love it.
Yeah. And that they were all so different. Yeah, it led me to more trust every time, because even with Blossom, I had those dreams, and like my body knew something was going on, and it communicated to my brain, and we acted on it like there was something there. And so here with Amber, it was just like a total time of love. I think my husband had quit school, so we had more time together and spent a lot of time, you know, just doing a lot of outdoor stuff. And it was just a beautiful time. She was born in June, by my dates and by what the midwife thought, that she was like she'd come a couple of days early, but after she was born, it was apparent she was way overdue. So she weighed 9 pounds, and I had felt so open and ripe and like swaggering around every step I took. And like the baby was literally hanging between my legs for a couple of weeks. But no, you know, nothing that, and I had nothing to fear. It wasn't like something's going wrong because I'm overdue. You know, it was just totally free minded. Didn't have a thing to think about. And so when I went into labor at the peak of that lunar eclipse, I would have a contraction, and it blew my mind because I'd never heard of an orgasmic birth. I didn't know what was going on, but there was no pain at all. And every time I'd squat down, and it was just like, it was an orgasmic birth. Every contraction was pleasurable. And it was crazy. And there wasn't very many, it was like 3 or 4. And I remember walking into the bathroom and looking in the mirror and, my eyes had this glazed look, and it's like, oh my gosh, the baby's coming. And I look in the mirror, and there's Scarlett behind me. She's like 3 years old, like rubbing her eyes. And all of a sudden, I just felt this kind of plump. And it's like, Jose, you better get in here. I think the baby's coming. Still had my skirt on, and went around the corner. He lifted the skirt up, and there was the baby's head. And we called the midwife at, you know, so it was 30 minutes. So he called at 30 minutes. She lived in Minneapolis. And I laid on the bed. I was like, oh my gosh, the midwife's not here. I can't do anything. And so I'm just laying on the bed, just talking and chatting like we are now. And it's like, oh, here comes a contraction. And it was like I was completely normal and felt nothing more than if you were to pee or nothing that would even concern you. And the baby, I just felt my body, that involuntary baby came right out, slipped out so easily, the squishy 9-pound baby, and so perfect. And like, we were just blissed out. It was so amazing. It's like, oh my gosh. And the fear behind it, like the midwife's not here, so we can't do anything because what if something goes wrong? It's just so funny to hold on to that through different times, thinking, trusting ourselves completely, but yet thinking somebody else has to tell me it's okay. So I think even at that third birth, through that, and then she comes knocking and comes into the house, and there's the baby, and it's all such a party because it was just such an amazing time. And then to see the full moon and the lunar eclipse was just, you know, icing on the cake. So at that point, it's like, we don't fear birth at all. So it was Scarlet Blossom Amber. Next baby we were in Tucson, and you know, it was sometimes a struggle to pay a midwife. And okay, so also that was the thing in 1983 with Amber. The midwife we had was somebody who I wanted to be. We went to her house in Minneapolis. She had a sweet little girl, and they ate natural food, and they had hardwood floors and this beautiful, you know, rustic old house. And the life she lived as a midwife, and me laying on the couch and her with her hands on my belly, and so calm and confident and sweet, and living the dream life where you're not rushing off to work and being somewhere, like this is your life. And I wanted that. It just like, that is what I want to do. This is my heart's calling. And so after Amber, I did sign up with the Carla Hartley program, Apprentice Academics. And that was in the day of snail mail. So, you know, I'd fill out stuff, and some of it was confusing. I didn't understand, like book reports and how they wanted us to do things. And, you know, a little lost and caring for three little kids and eventually getting pregnant again. And I just kind of gave it up. Although I read through all the material, it just became a loose link and never really finished that. But the desire never left me at all. So with Atticus, like I say about really sometimes struggling to pay the midwife because it was one person working on probably minimum wage at the beginning. But that third midwife, like at the farm, it was free. I think we donated whatever, and we worked while we were there for a keep. So the second one, Blossom, with the emergency thing, because I had that dream and we had the midwife meet us there, they covered it under patient transport. And so we did not have to pay for that birth. Third birth was Amber, and that midwife was $300 in 1983. And even that was a chunk. So it's kind of hard to see how this has all changed and all. So the fourth baby, Tucson, we loved our life. It was, you know, he was a beekeeper, and things were going really well. And there was a really cool kind of hippie lady right down the road from us who was a midwife, had been a midwife, had gone through the training, hadn't been practicing lately. And I think she got into dental school or something. So we got her for a bargain price of whatever, I think another $300. But she was so nervous throughout. I think that we found her at the end. But that labor, that completely changed everything because she was so nervous. We would squat through contractions. There she was, like listening to the heart tones, squatting down there with us. It's like, what is she doing? This is crazy. But, you know, she was all licensed, you know, probably going under some license or all the things she had to do. She was so intrusive after Amber's birth, which was the orgasmic one, and all by ourselves, and everything was beautiful and perfect. And I was trusting so much more by then. It was apparent that we did not need this extra person at our birth. So at his birth, he is a blessed child. He came out in the call, and he's had several should have been death experiences. And I'm going up to Seattle on Friday, actually, to help him because he had a severe accident. But he is blessed. And I knew from the beginning, like, you're going to get through this one too. So he's had a couple of major accidents like that. But so he was a day birth. I had prodromal labor with him for a couple of weeks on and off. My husband would go to work. I'd call him home or he'd stay home. And then the labor would peter out. And I felt like I was making it up and I was in tears and like, this baby's never going to come. And it was just, it was very trying because I didn't know what was going on. But once I went into labor, and so all my labors were like 6 hours, 2 hours, 30 minutes. Atticus was 6 hours. And he was more intense. It was a day birth, so there was more distractions. And the midwife came, and he was in the call, and everything worked out fine. So there was no problems. But I did not like her interference during the laboring period. So we decided at that birth, we don't need a midwife anymore because either they don't make it or they're intrusive, and we're paying them anyway. So let's just do this on our own. So my husband, we had like special delivery, and he would read that in the last days of my pregnancy every time. And it was just, the whole pregnancy was so beautiful because we knew we were doing it, and it was a family affair, and we were completely one. And in my labor, we were completely one. I know I've seen a lot of women who want to be independent and just be in their own primal thing and birth a baby that way. And my daughter did. It was amazing. But for me, like, we're one, and we were one from the time we met, and we still are. And we've been together 40 years. So when I went into labor, he was there with me. And so he would read these, you know, the night before the next baby was born here in Prescott in a different house. And he was a 2 hour labor. And so from then on, there were like 2 hours, 2.5 hours, maybe 4 hours, then back down to 2 hours. And I think because the peace that I had, I didn't have to go through a bunch of stress. Like, I'm, oh, here's my body doing this. Oh, here it goes again. Oh, now I'm here. Now I can tell what's going on. And now I'm in transition. Mm-hmm. Even though in my mind, like, I felt like I was tripping or something, I knew, like, there was part of me that could tell where I was and that it was all okay. Even when the labors didn't go, you know, standardly, they were all different. So when Forrest came, it was a couple hours. He was born. Yes. Go ahead.
I wanted to ask you, were your other children present during the subsequent births of their siblings? Like, was it a full family affair? Oh, that's awesome.
It always was to the very last one, which was the 14th. And it, by that time, it was kind of humorous. But yeah, that was one of my points. Like, I knew the fear stories that I heard in my generation. And that was when, like, in 1980, that's about when all the midwifery was starting to pick back up again. Like, it had been stamped out. And so, of course, midwifery was, you know, underground in Illinois and probably many other places and is still, you know, being revived. I didn't know that I was on, you know, just the beginning, because the farm was founded in like the late 70s. This, you know, bus train from California and a bunch of hippies. And along the way, people started having babies and the women would go over and, like, they would help deliver the baby. And so when they got to Tennessee, they found a backup doctor. And that's just the way the whole thing started. Like, they just started attending each other and probably reading whatever material they could get their hands on, but not leaning on anybody else. They were just, you know, attending each other. And so that was really the beginning, the revival of midwifery. And so in 1983, when I had that heart's calling, it never left me. And then in school to find out, wow, I was just right in the beginning wind of all of that. So that, it was pretty cool. And then with Forrest, we were up here and things were going okay. He was a quick birth. My husband was here. He had read the night before, if the cord is around the neck, blah, blah, blah. And he was so happy when that baby came out and the cord is around the neck. And he felt like, wow, I just read that. I know just what to do. It's not scary, because I would have been scared thinking, oh no, what if I bleed? Every time, like, I bleed maybe a half a cup with every single birth. I just don't bleed. But every time I worried about a hemorrhage, because that was the one thing, like, you hear, what if you bleed too much? And so that definitely was a thing in my mind. But also, I kind of had feared blood at that point. So I think that was just something in my mind I had to overcome. So that was Forrest. And then next, so we did move around a lot. We were in Minnesota for Sunshine. And she was a 2 hour labor and she had a super short cord. Like, when she was born, you know, again, he'd read the books days before. We'd call all the kids in, 2 hour labor. He would know, like, should I get the kids? Like, no, not yet. And then the next one, he said, no, I'm going to go get the kids. And every single time I would say, nope, don't get them yet. We're fine. And he would know when to get them and all the kids would come in. And so all the way they attended. And so with the last one, we had grown-up kids and the ones that were in town, we called them and they got there. The kids that were in the house got up and they opened the door. It's like, they watched me have the baby. go back to bed now. It's like, here we go again. Mm-hmm. I've seen this so many times, Mom. But, you know, that's mm-hmm. what I want them to know. I heard the fear stories and I wanted them to not be afraid of birth. It's just part of life and it's not a big deal. And every one of the girls and boys, I do believe, feel that. And so I've attended all my grandchildren's births except a couple. One came early and one was out of state. I go out of state, but at that time it didn't work out. So like 10 of the 12 grandkids, I was at their birth, or I was the only one attending the birth. Beautiful. They didn't have a midwife. So I was the one. So yeah, they went on to trust birth as well. And it just makes me so happy. And the same, one of my daughters, Sonora, she's in Seattle. I'll see her while I'm up there. She's due in December. So I'm going to get to attend her as well.
Cool. That's awesome.
Yep. I know. Yeah. So Sunshine was great. A couple hour labor, again, brought the kids in. Like, it was just a baby with a short cord. Once the placenta released, he put it in a bowl, put it up there, you know, and everything. The nursing just went from one baby to another. When I started nursing, I didn't end for 28 straight years. So that was an interesting ride, along with all the other. When I hear some of these numbers now, it's like, wow, we went the whole nine yards. That was crazy. But I wouldn't trade my life for anything. So it might sound crazy, but it's been super fun. Mm-hmm. So Sunshine, that was Minnesota. The next one, Abraham. So we left Minnesota in search of finally settling down, because we had been from state to state, to Minnesota, Tennessee. We lived in Texas. We lived all over the place and did a lot of hitchhiking in the beginning, bought a lot of buses. I think we counted one time that we've owned 7 buses. We've moved in buses. We had a lot of fun with those. So we moved in a bus in a snowstorm and a blizzard. We had 3 feet of snow, but we were out of Minnesota and we weren't coming back. So that was a nice goodbye. But I was like 7 months pregnant with Abraham. So here we're heading to the Southwest, where it's warm and sunny and beautiful. And got here, found a place. So by that time we had like 8, let's see, he was the 8th one, I think. Yeah, so he was the 7th one. And so with all the other kids, when we came to town in Prescott in like around 1991, it was very short housing, very limited employment, and people could be super picky, and it was very hard to find a place. And most people would have a stack of 50 applications, and we just wanted, you know, a nice house out in the woods. And so here's another interesting point. In Minnesota, my daughter Scarlett, my firstborn, I think she's about 12 or 13, and she wrote our dream life in a log cabin outside of a small town in the woods and the garden and like the whole dream picture. And I really didn't even remember that she had written that until after we found it, when we found our place. So we were looking at all different ones, and we could not find a place for our family. That we weren't going to live in Prescott Valley. We wanted to live in Prescott, where it was, you know, an older town and beautiful Prescott Valley. We didn't want to live there. So one of our last places we looked at, and it turned south, and it's like, my husband said, okay, I think we should get on a mule train and just like ride through the desert for a while. And all these fun things, like, no, let's go try one more place. And so we found this log cabin in the woods for rent. And there were so many people looking at it when we were in. It was a sweet old lady. And while we were looking at it, there were people driving back and forth on the front of the road, people sitting in the garden. It's like on a half acre, like people were waiting to, you know, take a look at it. And like, why would they pick us? We have 6 kids. They have no kids. You know, we're a burden to anybody. And they fear if they're renting to us, like that many kids are probably going to destroy it, which we never would. But anyway, this lady liked us and she let us rent it. And she said, maybe someday you'll get to buy it. And that's what we did. So we probably wouldn't have qualified for a loan because, you know, our life, we moved around and like we had so many kids. We never had a big bank account. We didn't have probably good credit or anything, but we bought it through her. So the whole picture I want to paint is that like when you follow your heart and your truth and your calling, like it works out. And I could never write down on paper how that could have happened. But, you know, the vehicles we drove, the places that we found, the house that we bought. We've lived in this house for 30 years now. And from Abraham, when we actually got into this place, I was 8 months pregnant by that time. And he was the first one born in this house. And the remainder of our children were born here as well. So it's pretty epic.
That is so epic. Yeah. And you said it was Scarlett that wrote it all out.
She had written what our dream life would be. And where we were living in Minnesota, we had a cool place out in the country. It was in the country and it was like on a golf course, but it was a mobile home. Mm-hmm. And it was nice, but mm-hmm. it was in an area yeah. and they were all mobile homes. And every once in a while, one would burn down. So she said, here's my present life. You know, houses are burning down. And, you know, and it was actually true. And she had a picture with all of that. And here's our dream life, living in the woods, like little house in the prairie and blah, blah, blah. And so this house, you know, this log cabin on half an acre, we boarded a national 2 million acres. You know, we're like an hour and a quarter from Sedona and an hour and a half from Phoenix and a couple hours from Flagstaff, so, and 6 hours from Mexico, which was a big important thing to us to be able to build a heritage down there as well with our family, because from the beginning to the end, and we kept having kids, we started going to Mexico 30 years ago, twice a year. And so now all the grown-up kids who are like 40 and under, from wherever they live, they'll meet us down in Mexico and we spend like a week on the beach and catch up on everything. So it's been an amazing thing to like have certain things in mind that you want to do. And at the beginning, like planting a little tree, well, someday it's going to be big and you're going to get fruit, or here's what we want our family to look like down the road when everybody's grown up, and what kind of relationship we wanted to have with them, and how all of that was, we were going to get from here to there, and just every day between, you know, 40 years of child raising. So it's paid off. I'll tell you, you know, you invest yourself in that. It seems it's harder to do, I think, these days because there's more demands on families and all of that, but you just can't go wrong having babies for sure. So I'm sorry to get off on that, but it really is.
No,
the big picture.
I love,
so that was,
I love the side tangents, all about them.
I'm glad. Okay, good. Yeah, the timely and all of that. So Israel was our next baby. And like I say, we were just like every year and a half or so, we'd have another baby. I'd be pregnant. It would be a smooth pregnancy. I did go. So in our town, there's a small little town, Cottonwood, and there's an old fashioned doctor. He's about 78 right now. And he loved me and he knew we were doing home births, but he would do my prenatal along the way. And, you know, sweet, kind, he would just like, you know, the sweet little smile, and he'd call his daughter and look at her belly. And he would bring people in, look at her belly. It'd be really big and brown and no stretch marks and like, you know, 12th baby or something. He was just the sweetest guy. And so when I had twins, he said that he would deliver them there. It wouldn't be an emergency. I wouldn't have to have a cesarean. He wouldn't air back me to Phoenix, that he knew me well enough that he would deliver those babies in the hospital. It's a small town. Like he would meet me there. There's probably nobody even hardly at the hospital. So that was the plan with those babies. So anyway, we knew him along the way and we would do our prenatal care with him. So, you know, we'd do the prenatal care. We'd have our little date down there and go to the health food store and, you know, somewhere to eat while we'd do our prenatals. And then eventually we'd have another baby, couple hour labor, everything went smoothly, like not really even a hiccup, barely. You'd go to sleep, you'd wake up in the morning and there's that baby laying between you, like looking around at everything in the world. And it was, and so we slept with our babies and all along the way. So that was Israel. Then Hannah. So Hannah was here after that. And she was such a sweet birth. And she was my largest baby. So it was like a 2.5 hour labor. She was 9 pounds, 2 ounces. Sweet labor, sweet baby, big chunky thing. And, you know, just continued nursing, continued life, like another baby, beautiful, you know, doting on them. The babies always make their presence known louder than anyone. So nobody gets neglected in a big family. Like everybody's taking care of everyone else. And I would think, oh my gosh, how can I spread myself so thin? But I realized like, you're not divided, you're multiplied because you've trained all these other babies that are getting bigger and they're motherly and loving and they know the ways and they've got all these people. Like you don't have to have eyes anywhere. You don't even have to have discipline because they all take care of each other by that point. Yeah, so that always worked out. So Israel was fine. Israel, Anna, then Sonora. Sonora was a posterior baby, and I had heard about the pain of a back labor and posterior labors are longer and prepare for, you know, complications and all these things. So I was a little nervous when I went into labor with her. And so she was a 6 hour labor, which after having a bunch of 2 hour labors, that was long. I didn't remember. It didn't seem like there was any terrible back labor. She came out fine. It was pretty much like the others, except it just took her a little bit longer. No tearing all the way. There was never any, there'd be skid marks. We knew what those were from the, you know, first couple of babies. They said, oh, you got skid marks. So my husband knew what that was. I never tore at any point. So that was good. And so, let's see, there's Jesse. We had them in different bedrooms. We were doing remodeling and adding on to our house. And so one baby might be born in this room and one baby born in that room. And so it's funny when they come back now, like, I was born in that room. Or, you know, it's just pretty cute. But again, you know, Jesse was just a beautiful, robust 8-pound baby in normal labor. And then I did have a couple of miscarriages along the way. So after Atticus, or after, between Amber and Atticus, I had a miscarriage. And that was just normal. I think the baby came out wholly in the bag, and it was about the size of a small water balloon. And there was no bleeding, and it was really, so we just told everybody I was pregnant and then lost the baby, but it was within that beginning period, so it was normal. But then after Jesse, I had a miscarriage, and I was like 4 months pregnant and started bleeding. And it's like, oh no, gosh, this is kind of late to have a miscarriage. And continue to bleed and bleed and bleed. And I remember getting up to go to the bathroom once, and it was daytime, so I must have been starting to pass out or something, because I just wanted to sleep. And getting up, and big clots were falling out. And then by that point, I mean, they were like, I remember clearly like a handful size, and I'd lost maybe, you know, maybe three of those and some other blood along the way. And so my husband called Dr. Jockins. We drove down to Cottonwood. It was about an hour or so, hour and a quarter away. And he helped to remove the rest of it. And there was the baby. Oh, and the baby did come out at that point, but I continued to bleed. Like the placenta probably didn't detach or something. So we had the baby, and you could clearly see she was about maybe 3 inches long. And, you know, just like a little model that you would see of one, you know, newborn baby and a little fetus in there. And it was really sad because it was later and I really felt bonded, and the bleeding and all of that just seemed, it was much more dramatic. And we buried the baby in our yard. So, you know, we made it beautiful, but it's sad. And I realized, like, who do you talk to about that? Like, nobody really knows. And what do they say? Like, you know, so I just really have a lot of sympathy and want to help any woman that ever goes through that, because it's just kind of a silent thing that you kind of bear on your shoulders alone, and there's not much support for it. So,
yeah. And ask you too, at the time, I mean, did you end up finding support or like a women's circle, sister circle around the area? Because what year was that?
Okay, so he was born in 96. No, wait. Yeah, that's right, 96. Yeah, there was more support then. And because we lived in the same town and we have a small community, and there was all the library friends, and you knew the cool people. But even there, like, I didn't really have a close friend to talk about that. Like, we'd talk about maybe other mm-hmm. birthy stuff. And the midwives, I was friends with Paula here. She's been a midwife forever, like nearly 40 years. And so that plays a part in where I'm at now, which is very interesting. In a way, it kind of sharpened me and honed me to be what I am now boldly, where it was different mm-hmm. before. Yeah, no. So there was support as far as like people who really, that we have a lot of respect in the town. We've been here so long, and, you know, we've been a good family. So, you know, people trust us, and we've had different dealings between our businesses. And my husband does his own business. And, you know, so a lot of the community knows this, and we've been in the homeschool group. So there's been generation after generation, like 4 generations of kids and parents that have grown up with our kids, because I would always do like all the field trips and organize all that. So there was support in that way. So that was really good. And it is kind of private. And by having a lot of kids around, but that did help, because they were all, you know, caring. And like the birth I was at a couple of days ago, as soon as the mama had the baby, here's the 1-year-old bringing her scones and a banana, like anything he could do to help her. And even as a baby. So when you have teenagers and things, like, they really do pamper you and care for you. And that makes up for not having a circle, I think, in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
So with Abraham was really a big boy. He had a 15 and a half inch head, and he was 8.5 pounds, but his head was humongous. We always tease that he looked like Howdy Doody on the cover of Mad Magazine because his ears actually did stick out in his head. He looked just like that. So I'm serious. Like, we somewhere, it's like, don't they look alike? Oh my gosh. And not in it, like, not to make fun of him, but he had a really huge head. And so when I went into labor with him, and that was here in the house, and it was a storm. And so we got to the point like, oh, let the baby drop into the birth canal, get the kids. And so they all came down from the loft and they're sitting around the wood stove, like a whole room full of kids. And normally like one or two pushes, the baby pops out, and never had anything different than that. And so here we were on the stormy day and the wood stove going and just this ominous thing and nothing, like a bowling ball. It felt like a bowling ball went in between, you know, right down the birth canal. And my husband, you know, he got nervous right away. Is something wrong? Should we do something? It's like, no, I have this piece. Like, no, there's nothing wrong. It's just going to take a lot of work to push out. And I pushed 2 hours. And it wasn't like pushing where you're swelling anything. It was like literally pushing a log or a bowling ball through my body. And, you know, I have big babies. Like, that's has not been a problem for me. But he had such a large head. And he was born perfectly fine. Like, everything worked out great. But that was completely different. So having that experience and thinking he grew big right away. And so the midwifery care that I would get through like practicing nurse midwives whatever town, if we're in Minnesota or whatever, they thought it was twins. And I started thinking, oh my gosh, I'd have these babies. That would be so cool to have twins. And so that went on for just a short amount of time. And then it became apparent it was one big baby. but it put my mind up. So then Israel, Sonora, Jesse, everyone, oh, maybe it'll be twins. Like, I want to have twins. Like, I would be so perfect for twins. I really want twins. I just hope that I have twins. I think I'm going to have twins. And I just like, not obsessed in a bad way, but really focus like every time, maybe this is the time. And so then I was pregnant and it was the twins, but I didn't know it. So we went down to Dr. Jockham's and it's a little bit of a drive. And the day we have to leave from Prescott. My husband got off work and it was a windy day and we fought the wind all the way there and got there like 15 minutes late. And whoever the receptionist was didn't know that you're not supposed to turn away Prescott people, because if they're late, you don't turn them away, you let them in. But she chewed us out for being late and sent us away. And so we argued all the way home. It was a very, instead of going out to eat and all the beautiful, you know, like our big trip and all of that, we just, you know, we spat all the way home and it was really sad. And so we had an appointment a week later and went back down there, left earlier, got there. So I'm laying back and Dr. Jockham, because I think I just got one ultrasound at some point, I think from Abraham on, before that, no ultrasounds, but with Avon, one ultrasound for pregnancy. And so this is our ultrasound time. And I'm laying back on the thing and he's doing his thing. And Dr. Jockham's on one side, my husband's on the other. And he's looking at it. And I'm looking at this primitive, you know, drawing. And says, well, what do you see? And it's like, I don't know, maybe a girl. And he says, well, maybe two girls. And it's like, I looked at the machine. I could see there were two. And I swear, if I hadn't been laying on the table, I would have passed out. I just, that moment on was a dream. And I look at my husband and they're like grinning ear to ear, filling up the entire room with this joy. It was so exciting. So we drove back and instantly I had the baby's name, Silas and Judah, and went on. So it was interesting with him. And it just, you know, I'm telling people, we have twins, Silas and Judah. And it just was so exciting to me. So the interesting thing was I continued the thinking. So in my mind, and this was in 1990, I don't think Marin was even practicing then when I thought back on it, because that was 20 years ago. She may not have even lived in Sedona then. Because later I thought, man, if I would have known Marin, I could have done it differently. But I didn't know that I could possibly have twins alone. I knew, like, this is not ego. I just want safe twins. Like, these twins are so precious to me. And so seeing Dr. Jockham, we made the deal. He was going to deliver them. If I could make it to 36 weeks, he would not air vac me. Everything would be fine. And so along the way, at some point, I think about 25 weeks, no counseling on nutrition or calories or anything. Well, I always gained about 50 pounds and I read the Brewer book from the time it came out. So that was always my Bible during my pregnancy. So I knew that much, but nobody to enforce it or to emphasize it or anything. That was just part of my plan of pregnancy every time. I gained 50 pounds. That time I gained, I think, 70 pounds maybe. But the cool thing was Paula in town, the main midwife, she said, well, I would like to follow you. Like, I can't be your midwife. I can't deliver twins, but I would like to have an appointment every month, just like I'm your midwife, and, you know, just see how this goes with the babies. But I don't think she ever told me the position of where the babies were, and nothing on nutritional counseling. So I felt, you know, she was always happy, and I think it was for her benefit more than anything that I learned. But it built a relationship, which was super valuable, because she couldn't legally deliver the twins. She wasn't going to be able to be my midwife, but she was a key player in the end. So started having contractions about 25 or 20, you know, early 28 weeks maybe. And so I had been at the farm and I had read Spiritual Midwifery and knew those stories by heart. And I knew when they went into labor, when they started having contractions, so I was probably more like 28 or even 30 weeks, that when they started having contractions, that they would drink a little alcohol to make the contractions go away. And I had not drank a drop of liquor in 25 years or, you know, forever since I was a teenager. But I had my husband go to the store and get some wine. And so I did that. Like every time the contractions would come, I'd drink a little wine. And so that bought me about a week. And then they started getting stronger and the wine didn't work anymore. So talked to Dr. Jockum, and he put me on something called Breathine, very small amount. And at that point, I think it was bed rest. So bed rest to me meant like it was still kind of fun. I'd lay on the couch and I'd go throw a little laundry in while I went to the bathroom. Maybe I'd go lay on the trampoline outside, or, you know, I was still up quite a bit, but, you know, mostly laying down. And then they got worse, and they just kept continuing and more intense and more intense until the morning they were born. So I kept them in until 36 weeks, and we had made the deal, if I could make the 36 weeks, that he would not air back me to Phoenix because of the date. So that morning, 8 o'clock, I had been drinking wine and like triple breathing or double breathing, whatever it was, like they had maxed it up. And fought till 5 o'clock in the morning. And I just had this contraction. I was like, I don't think I'm going to be able to keep them in any longer. And I knew that day was 36 weeks. So got up to go pee, had a contraction. I said, if we don't go right now, I don't think I'm going to, the babies are coming right now. All of a sudden they were just here. And so we called Paula. So the one who'd been following me all this time, she lived in Skull Valley about 45 minutes away, but was having sewer work done, happened to be at staying at her office in town, 10 minutes from our house. And she was on the way to Dr. Jockum's. So things were happening so fast. We said, can we stop and you can check her? So she came down to the van, checked me. I was 10 centimeters. So I hobbled up like 50 steps to get up to this cool old house where her office was. And we were excited because like we weren't planning on her delivering, but she was happy. Like it was happening and it was happening in her place and she was there and she couldn't help it. So she wanted to wait for the first midwife or an additional midwife to get there, Melody Fisher. So waited for Melody. I was like, do you guys have any olive oil? No, they had some margarine or something. I think they were trying to melt for me. And I was like, never mind. So they said, okay, well, you know, she's here. If he wants to come, just go ahead and let him. And so Silas, you know, just popped right out. I was standing there. She videotaped it and I never saw it, but she said I was just smiling through the whole thing. Like, no problem. He was 4 pounds, 12 ounces. And so, you know, I'm holding him and nursing him, you know, things are going on for like about two hours. And so she's getting nervous because if you read any of the things about twins, it all says in the studies, they should come within a few minutes or 30 minutes or, you know, all these times, not like the longer it takes, the more chances of trouble that there could be. But I wasn't bleeding. Nothing was going on. I think she probably had cut the cord at that point just for convenience, but I'm not sure. I don't remember. I'd have to ask my husband. But nothing was happening. She said, well, maybe we should call the paramedics just to back me up since I'm not supposed to be delivering these babies. You know, you can still stay here, but just so they're here just in case. And so to backtrack, just a week before, two of our teenage boys, one of them had an accident where he dislocated his elbow on a skateboarding accident in our house. So we had all these really handsome, burly paramedics at our house helping him. And she wanted to call those same guys. And I was like, no, forget it. Let's just go down to, you know, if you want to call the paramedics, I don't want them standing here when I'm having a baby. Let's just drive down to Cottonwood. Nothing's happening. I wasn't having any contractions. So I'm just standing there. I don't remember sitting down. I think I was standing the entire time, nursing the baby. So got back in the van. I lay in the front seat. My husband's driving, midwife's in the front seat. So we're friends, you know, we've known each other at that point, 20 years or something. And we have teenagers and teenager problems. And, you know, we're just chatting about it. But when I turn sideways, and this will make the most sense, then Judah, the second one, kind of turned like a torpedo because he was laying transverse, like parallel across my rib cage, and he wasn't turning. And so probably at their house, if I would have laid down, the baby would have turned and come right out, but just stayed in that position because I kept standing. So once I laid down, I could feel movement in there. And we're just chatting and talking. And I think it was a big storm, huge storm. And we have to go down, down, down the mountain. I was kind of nervous about that. And so at one point, it's like, maybe you should hurry up a little bit because I can feel it getting stronger. And they're talking. At one point, it's like, you guys, I'm having a baby back here. Like, quit talking. I didn't say that, but that's the way I felt. Like, I knew it. And so I'm saying, well, maybe you should hurry a little bit. And so we're taking all these small little roads to get to the hospital. And so he said, okay, well, here's a big turnout. If you think you can make it. And so Paula's calling, okay, we've got one baby. And I was nursing Silas, laying on that front bench, and Melody Fisher was driving behind. And so I had two midwives around and all that. And making sure the hospital's prepared when we get there, because the second one hadn't come, but the contractions were getting closer and faster and stronger. And I said, oh no, we can make it. It's only like two more blocks. And the second he passed that wide spot, I was like, oh no, pull over right now. So we pull over in this little muddy, it was pouring down rain. He jumps out of the driver's seat and comes around the side. So Judah comes out in the van, and Melody came from the rain in her car, and she got in the van. So we have, this little party in our big van. And so then I hand Silas to my husband. Paula, the midwife, gets in the driver's seat. And then Paula's on the way. Well, we got two babies, still no placenta. We'll be there in a minute. So I waddled in, squatted over a bowl, gave them the placenta, and our doctor came in, and a little bit about that, but he let us go home 4 hours later. So, and the second baby was 5 pounds, 14 ounces. So there's like a pound and 2 ounces difference between them. No problem at all. As soon as I turned, the baby was fine. He came out like Superman with his hand first. But here's the thing that I want to emphasize through the whole trust process and trusting your body and trusting birth and being in that place, not being afraid. Because when the placenta came out and Dr. Jockum looked at it, he turned ghost white. Paula had noticed this. So it had the velamentous cord. So normally on a placenta, you see the tree of life and the cords attached and, part of it. With the velamentous cord, the veins are all loose. And so he turned white because he knew if I had been in the hospital, he would not have waited to, it was 2¾ hours by the time the second one came. That he would have reached in there and turned the baby and probably ripped those cords loose, and we would have bled to death, him or I or both. And that's why he turned white, because he would have interfered and caused a problem. And there was absolutely zero problem doing it naturally with no intervention. So me, that was like, totally. It proved it. Like, that's it. That is it. Like, that surmises everything you could see, like almost 3 hours between the labor. And all the things that you could imagine and be scared that will go wrong. And you have that kind of placenta, you can't do it on your own. And what could happen? And nothing happened. And not to say that there's never, but I knew. I wasn't worried about it. And I didn't feel any, when I did know that there was something wrong with Blossom, like my body told me I had that. There's other ways to know things like that too. You know, and just being in tune with your body and really trusting and all of that. And so to me, that was the high point, like how many things could have gone wrong and how many different ways that could have looked. And it was like the best birth story we ever had, like two babies born in 2 pounds, like hours apart. You know, one of the friend made a shirt for them. I was born in Prescott. I was born in Cottonwood. And, just knowing, well, there's mile marker 296 where Judah was born. And, it's kind of a funny story around town. Just beautiful. So I got pregnant one more time after that, and that was Ruby. She was the last one. And the funny thing is, I thought I'd try a water birth with the cloth tub. And when she was born, we had all the kids come, again, like I say, from out of town and everything. By that time, it was like, yawn, this is boring. Can we go back to bed? But with her, she had such a sucking instinct. And so it's funny to see in pregnancies and in birth and then later how the child reveals his personality and things like that. That she came out sucking her thumb, and she had blisters on her fingers from sucking them. And that was the only baby I tore on, like my very last baby I tore, because she had her hand up there sucking her thumb when she came out. And she nursed till she was 5 years old. And I think she only stopped because one of my other kids kind of shamed her and harassed her at some point. Yeah. So she finally stopped. But the sucking instinct, like, she had it. And I think, you know, satisfying the oral fixation can help in the future. But that's a whole other story. So that's a lot of birth stories. Your ears are
probably
red. Yeah,
that was beautiful. That was beautiful. Thank you so much. And then how long after that did you eventually, did you start, you know, going down the midwifery path? I know that you said that you had, or correct me if I'm wrong, you said that you had during that whole time, while you were birthing your children, attended other friends' births, yes. Probably around the same town. Okay. And then I think you went to a course, you had said as well, or there was a course. It was an apprenticeship course.
Yep. Apprentice Academics with Carla Hartley. I think Marin went through some of that too, probably after it was refined. This is like the beginning stages of that. But no, that desire was in my heart and in all ways, like friends at some point after living here, the friend group that I had, some of these ladies started calling me to their births. They didn't want a midwife. They just wanted a friend who they felt confident in birth. So by the time I ended up starting midwifery school, I had like 80 births under my belt. And they were all like my births because these women believed they could do it. They weren't expecting trouble. And the babies were fine. Everything was always fine. And so in my mind, in my bubble, you know, this is the way birth is and every woman should and can, and probably is experiencing it. Right. I had no idea what was going on in the medical world and the way the popular culture was looking at birth and how much fear there was and how much control between the doctors and how far it had gone. You know, in my world, it was a totally beautiful, rosy picture. So it was quite the shock. So along the way, I'm attending births and I'm reading every new birth book that comes along and, you know, have all this information under my belt until Ruby was about 10 years old, I believe, maybe 9 or 10. And I started having some free time because we also homeschooled. So many of those years while I was birthing babies, we were educating 7 grades at a time in our home, you know, with all these different things going on and little toddler babies and all this, you know, all the stuff. So along the way, you know, with all the different things, helping women and herbs and all the things. So if you've ever seen the Karate Kid, this kid, like he wants to do karate so bad, but the master has him like waxing the car this way and waxing the car that way and doing all these moves. And so by the time I entered the real birth world, I had all these Karate Kid moves of herbs and wisdom and birth and in so many deep rooted ways that once I came to it, it's just like, I already had all this other stuff around me and it was so easy to move right into that. So when she was about 9 or so, it was a New Year's, all of our families down at Date Creek, we go hunting crystals down. It's about 45 minutes from our house. And so everybody who had come for Christmas, we went for New Year's and camped down there. And so New Year's Day, we're out plinking around and eating and drinking and we're all saying our New Year's resolution and everybody had wonderful ones. And I loudly announced, I'm going to become a doula. And then, so I did, like I took the training and within 3 months I had all the births. I had all the stuff I got certified. It was like, oh, okay, that was easy. And then I became a placenta encapsulator and then childbirth educator and birthing from within and spinning babies and Gina Kirby Rebozo and, a couple of different placenta encapsulation things and vaginal steaming and sacred living movement with sacred pregnancy and pregnancy retreats and giving those for women and postpartum care and like everything I could do for a pregnant lady without actually being the midwife because I thought I missed my boat. So it never satisfied me. Like I kept myself busy. I had an office. My office is in my house now. And doing everything I could to help women. I just wanted to help women through this biggest part of their life and help them to understand what they're capable of and to meet that and be ready and all, you know, anything I could do in any way to help them. And then the midwifery school opened up and I'm looking at that like, oh my gosh, I'm in my 50s. Am I too old to do this? Like, is anybody going to even want me? I'm like my hair's gray and I don't know. There's all these young people that are already still in the birth world and all these things. Like, I don't know. And then I just decided, yep, I'm still attending births. My kids are still going to call me to births. I'm still going to be going to births. I want to know everything I possibly can. So when I went to school, it was such a delight to me because I've been teaching my kids, you know, for all these years and that was past me. And I got to focus completely on myself. And I'd get up at 5 a.m. and I would study and read and research. And it just like, I was a sponge. I was so excited to be able to like fill this really tiny part. I felt like a tiny part of the big picture of a pregnant woman, you know, pregnancy, birth, and postpartum. And not that it wasn't hard or not that there's not so much involved, but I'd had so many experiences prior that once I got this knowledge, it's like, oh my gosh, I could have called myself a midwife 20 years ago. Seriously, in so many ways. And that's what I'll say about Indie Birth Midwifery School. To me, like, there can't be any better school. They teach everything that is so innate, integral, and deep-rooted in a woman's makeup. Like, that's what they teach. That's the way they help support the women in birth, in all of that. And that is the truth. Like, not all this medical jargon, like, here's how you stitch up the lady, and here's what you can use all these medicines for, and here's all the, you know, in the way the pharmaceutical, and here's the midwife way of thinking. And like, those don't fit. That does not make sense in birth. And it just brings fear and distrust of a woman's own body to have that kind of a myth. But I also know, you know, just different practices that midwives have that could interfere with birth. And I just practice differently. So it's all good.
It's all good.
Yeah. Well, that's why I'm grateful for Maren and Margaret's training, because they are speaking the truth and they are training women to believe in themselves and to believe in the women that they're finding to help. You know, the women that mm-hmm. have confidence in themselves, and they need somebody else to support them that has the confidence in them as well, and not bringing the fear by saying, oh, you should do this, you should take this, and, you know, do all the standard things, all the, you know, because the government says that's the way it should be.
Totally.
Rather than trusting them and letting them make decisions, and it makes them feel like they have the power and they know they're the one that is going to birth the baby. Like, I can't tell them where to scratch if it itches. They know, not me. So it's a beautiful thing. By the time we get to where they birth, there's just so much trust. It's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, well, Valerie, thank you so much. This has been such a joyous conversation. It's been, I'm kind of a little on cloud nine after hearing your stories. It's, yeah,
there's
so
a lot
beautiful.
Of in there. Yeah, and it's just the flow. Yes, I mean, totally. Really, I feel with oxytocin now just even thinking about it, because they were births, and the kids all know. And so we have adopted our 15th boy, my oldest. We ended up getting her youngest child. He's now 6, and he lived with us since he's about 1.5 years. And he's working the garden. He's seen me with the herbs, and he watches me prepare, and he's seen me do the placentas. And that boy knows more about placenta encapsulation and what herbs women need. And when he pretends and makes his food and makes his herbal, you know, all of his things, and he's got his own garden and he's growing his own herbs now. And it's like, man, what an opportunity for these new people. Like, we are creating, some really great people for the future.
Yes. Yes. Totally.
It all starts at birth. These babies that come out in such peace and love are going to change the world. That's my mm-hmm. opinion.
Yes, they
it's the continuum.
Will. Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
Yes.
Is there any last little bits of wisdom that you would like to share with our listeners?
Besides the, you know, everybody says, trust your body, trust birth, those kind of things. Like, you can say them like a mantra and maybe not even really feel them. But I think the biggest thing above that is showing that you trust it by, you have to run toward it, like with open arms and embrace it. And know that when you go into labor that day, like, you've done a lot of work from the time you've been pregnant to the day that you have that baby, and it's your birthday. And you are going to greet your baby on that day. And it should be a happy and joyous time, and not fear, no fear. Your baby's in there. And it just takes a lot of work to get there. Like, you could trust yourself and the process, but it's also a lot of work, because, you know, I went from being a partying teenager, and I had to change a lot of things and continue to change them all the way to the end. And I'm still changing them. You know, we all want to be better all the time, but it's work. And I think sometimes we live in a society that, you know, it's easier. We don't have to work that hard if we don't want to. Like, there's always takeout food, or there's a convenience of some sort. And it's harder to make ourselves do the things that need done. You know, maybe it's a dietary change, or maybe it's a different getting out in nature more and moving more, and maybe having a pregnancy practice and spending more time in self-care when our society, you know, kind of neglects that as well, like changing some things and changing a little at a time, one thing at a time.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yay. Oh, thank you, Valerie. What? Thank you so much. I really, again, very much appreciate you and this conversation.
Jaden, it's been a pleasure. I love it. I hope somebody gleans something great from it.
I'm sure many people listening to this will learn many, many great things. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, thank if anybody
I
wants to reach out,
learned a lot of great things. What did you say?
No, it's beautiful. No, if anybody wants to reach out, I'm an open book. I might have a phone number. I have a couple of websites. You can look at my website if you're local. I do sacred postpartum training all over the world. You can find me on there. And she's probably going to put links, right, Jaden? I'm assuming somewhere.
But you can reach out. What is your website? Question.
The local one is sacredbirthtraditions.com. Mm-hmm. And then the postpartum training is sacredpostpartum.net. Cool. So I train women around the world so they can go to their communities and help women with vaginal steaming and belly binding and moxibustion and sealing ceremonies and birth story writing and Malaysian baths and, you know, all kinds of beautiful things to honor the mama. So it's been really exciting to see that grow and spread to all the communities because, you know, everywhere women need that care.
Cool. Well, thank you so much again.
For sure. You guys have a beautiful week. I'm heading up to Seattle, so hope to see you somewhere along the way, everyone.
Yes, you too.
Okay. Thank you, Jake.
Thank you so much for listening. Storytelling is a profound agent of change. One that has the ability to plant seeds of inspiration, introspection, and beyond. If you have an empowering birth story that you would like to share on our podcast, please head over to indiebirth.org/birthwarrior to send your submissions. That's indiebirth.org/birthwarrior. Hope you have a beautiful week wherever you are in the world. Until next time, friends.